Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And welcome, my friends, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. Actually, a break in the weather. My goodness. Got down below 200 degrees today. And actually, a lot of greenery out there. I drove across from Utah early this morning as we were demonstrating the new electric truck down there in Salt Lake. And was noticing how green everything was, how wonderfully beautiful and alive everything is. Very much different than what you normally see out in the wastelands of western Utah. Sunspots are made of magnetism. The firmament of a sunspot is not matter, but rather a strong magnetic field that appears dark because it blocks the upflow of heat from the sun's fiery depths. Without magnetism, there would be no sunspots. According to Bill Livingston and Matt Penn of the National Solar Observatory in Tucson, Arizona, sunspot magnetic fields are waning. That means they're beginning to go away. The two respected solar astronomers have been measuring solar magnetism since 1992. Their technique is based on Zeeman splitting of infrared spectral lines emitted by iron atoms in the vicinity of sunspots. Iron, as you know, is pretty much everywhere in the universe. Everything will eventually decay to iron, as the protons are the most stable and least energetic. Extrapolating their data into the future suggests that sunspots could completely disappear within decades. Don't count out sunspots just yet, however. While the data of Livingston and Penn are widely thought to be correct, far-reaching extrapolations may be premature. This type of measurement is relatively new, and the data reaches back less than 17 years, which is a kind of a small window to be looking at the sun. And they say whether this is an omen of long-term sunspot decline analogous to the Maunder minimum remains to be seen. I'll let you know what a Maunder minimum is. It's M-A-U-N-D-E-R for those of you taking notes for the test that will be at the end of this program. Just kidding. The Maunder minimum refers to a period of time between 1645 and 1715, when solar activity was extremely low. Contemporary scientists examined recorded data from the time and discovered that there were significantly fewer solar flares during those years. The Maunder minimum coincided with the Little Ice Age, a period of worldwide low temperatures. There have been 24 earthquakes greater than 2.5 in the world in the last 24 hours. Five of them have been more than 5.0 on the Richter scale. Our friends in Phoenix are getting ready to come out of the top of the hour CNN news. Want to let you know that we are live on KFNX 1100 in Phoenix, Arizona, 50,000 watts of X Squared Radio, bringing you the very leading edge of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. We want you to tune in and get squared. Last week we had open lines and we discussed global warming. If you missed it, there are some answers there to the global warming ideas that are being perpetrated upon the world. Not that we're against global warming, certainly not. We want to keep our eyes and ears open and see how things are going. So those of you in the Phoenix market, welcome to us, and we'll be back in 40 seconds with X Squared Radio and our guests. Don't go away. And welcome, my friends, Earth explorers everywhere, to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. Our AccuWindow forecast 70 degrees, well below the temperature of birds bursting into flame in midair like they did last week. Last week we had open lines, talked about global warming. Next week we have Ed Makowski coming on the program, author of two great books. We're going to try and talk about both of them, ancient Egyptian technology. Don't miss it. Tonight we are returning to one of the most incredible cold case files in history. This case is much more than a mystery. It has been the subject of more government cover-up stories than any other. It is at the heart of an entire genre of galactic speculation and adventure. I am speaking of none other than the Roswell UFO crash. And with us tonight is the co-author of Witness to Roswell. This team of investigators knows more than anyone alive about this historic contact between extraterrestrials and mankind. Don Schmidt is with us on X Squared Radio tonight. Welcome to the program.
Yes, good evening. Pleasure to be with you again.
Oh, my goodness. This is probably the most exciting story. And you know, people say, oh, gee, what's so different about Roswell? Don and Thomas Carey, his co-author, were on the program a year ago. And they had already discovered a lot, and now they've got a new edition of their book, Witness to Roswell, with a foreword by Edgar Mitchell, and it's just stunning.
Thank you.
I want to get into all the details of the story, but generally, how much have you learned in the last year?
Well, one of the obviously primary focuses of this now 20-year investigation, sadly, is making every effort to track down every surviving witness. As I just heard the figure again this morning, we're now up to 1,800 people a day of the World War II generation we're losing. So the attrition rate is only intensifying. And we sadly realize that in a few more years, every one of our witnesses will be passed on. And it's for that reason that we provide them with this opportunity. We certainly promote this very idea that there is strength in numbers, that with the wealth of circumstantial testimony, the eyewitness testimony, describing what happened in minute detail and creating this mosaic, this puzzle, piece by piece, that is all pointing to one and only one explanation. There isn't a month that goes by that we don't hear a new theory advanced from people who just refuse to look at the evidence, look at that testimony, and are willing to summarily dismiss such accounts. And yet we will accept testimony to put people as far as on death row, put them in prison for the rest of their lives. A lone witness can observe someone do something, and it's more times than not enough, you know, to set them free or, elicit a guilt conviction. And yet, we have now talked to over 600 people, directly or indirectly involved with this one incident. And they're all, you know, unanimously telling us that it was indeed the recovery of a crashed flying saucer and crew. In other words, there were bodies recovered.
And well, you know, I ask people all the time, and that includes people I would never have asked this question 10 years ago. Have you ever seen a UFO? And the answers are almost 100% to the affirmative. I've either seen one or I believe in them. And even those that haven't seen them, they want to. But out of the many thousands of really good UFO evidence cases out there, why have you concentrated on this one?
Well, there's no doubt we refer to this as the granddaddy of all UFO cases, because instead of waiting for the next sighting, the next landing, the possibility of, you know, a mass sighting involving, you know, hundreds of witnesses, and yet it's still a fleeting event, even though it may be captured on film, on video, it might be on the 10 o'clock news this evening. Roswell is where we received concrete evidence. It was where one actually dropped in our laps, and we were faced with, you know, that unprecedented, you know, conclusion that we were dealing with an intelligence off the planet. And not only the wreckage itself, but as I mentioned a moment ago, the very bodies. We, especially after the advent of the atomic bomb, just 2 years earlier, 1945, would have been able to dismiss and gain the cooperation of all the witnesses involved by just explaining this away as something top secret, some new technology developed post-World War II. But when the bodies are witnessed, when the bodies are described, that, you know, that rules out all such possibilities.
And well, yeah,
one of the officers said to us, they certainly work from Texas.
Yeah, so, and when the government steps in and starts lying about it, and then lying about the lying, and then backing up and lying again, then you really know something's going on.
Precisely. And it's one of the reasons that I often have commented how investigative journalism has become a lost art. And in any other situation, as you were just alluding to, I mean, they are now up to their fourth and probably devising a fifth explanation to what happened back in 1947. And after the second one, shouldn't that be a bit of a tip-off? I mean, doesn't that define the very term cover-up?
Yeah, exactly.
That they're hiding something?
Well,
and that's where we step in, and that's where these brave witnesses who have been willing to join the ranks of the many before them, and now even to their deathbeds, are finally confiding to their loved ones, to their spouses, to their children, and saying it wasn't the fourth explanation, it wasn't the third, it wasn't the second, it was indeed the first one, the actual acknowledgement that they had indeed captured a flying saucer. And so far, the government is batting zero. We have over 600 witnesses, and they have zero.
Wow.
So, slam dunk.
Photos are good, burn marks or, you know, bent grass on the ground is even better, but the best evidence possible is actual physical pieces of the craft or the whole craft itself. And most, if not all, of the sightings out there are whole craft that are just flying around, you know, eating cookies, drinking milk, minding their own business.
Right, right.
This one got a surprise from a storm that they were flying through and ended up crashing. And it turns out this is the case. And this is the team, and the time is fast escaping. And
yes,
the trail to the actual physical evidence passes through witnesses. So how many witnesses are still around?
I can't tell you how frustrating it has been at times. It's bad enough when we finally track down the family, as it would turn out, and they inform us that my husband or my father that passed away just a year or two ago. But when you hear of months and weeks. There was actually one occurrence where we called up just as the family was returning from the funeral.
Oh, my goodness.
And you just can't help but, you know, step back and say whatever information, whatever that person knew regarding this incident is gone forever. Short of their leaving notes or a diary or any paper trail, it's all gone. And to us, that is, it becomes all the more daunting as we look down the road, because we have to step up our efforts as a result. We are now focusing on key individuals with the hope that many of the younger soldiers, and at that time, we've early learned in the investigation that they were even lying about their ages just to go into the service, and they would be less than 18 at times. So we're still hoping that on the lower rank, and we're talking men who would now be in their early 80s. So there's a chance, and it's one of the reasons we just spoke to a surviving witness just said, last week once again. So it's not impossible, but we realize it's not like 20 years ago.
Sure.
When many of these people were just in their mid-60s. And if not for our lack of, you know, the technology to find them, now you just pop in a CD-ROM, and if you're listed in the phone book anywhere in the country, you know, we'll find you, especially if you have a name that stands out. Unfortunately, if it's a common name, we'll probably have about 1,000 of you. But 20 years ago, we were having to do credit checks. We were relying on air certification with the assumption that if these men were pilots during their military tenure, that they would still continue getting licensed as private pilots. We were going through motor vehicle, checking as far as license numbers, anything we could to track these people down. So it was a very laborious task, you know, at that time. It's amazing when I look back that we were finding people at the rate we were, but they were alive. That was the big difference, you know, during this duration of 20 years. Now it's the end game.
In case our listeners have only heard a piece or two of this story, or they've seen it on television and really not gotten the true story, what is alleged to have happened in the pasture during July of 1947?
Well, we always give a short synopsis, a background of New Mexico itself. I'm continually amazed, especially when I lecture on college campuses, and I always, you know, even toss the question out to the faculty who might be in attendance, where was the first atomic bomb detonated? And I'm surprised how many professors say Japan. And when you inform them, no, it actually happened right here in the United States, and you explain to them, you ask, did you ever hear of Trinity Site in New Mexico? And, oh, that's right, you know, never thought of that. Well, because it's something that doesn't receive a lot of attention. Even as tourists go, they only open the site once a year, where people are able to come in and actually buy a souvenir of the Trinidite, the glassified ground from the actual detonation, where the sand and the surrounding ground was all fused. So New Mexico was the hotbed of all military activity at that time. Not only did you have ongoing atomic research at Los Alamos, New Mexico, you had White Sands Proving Ground, where they were testing all the recovered German V-2 rockets after World War II. So after Robert Goddard, and as it turns out, Robert Goddard of Roswell, New Mexico, the true father of modern rocketry, you had a combination of rockets and atomic weaponry that was quickly coming together. And in Roswell itself, you had the 509th Atomic Bomb Squadron, the first atomic bomb squadron in the world. So the elite, the most highly trained, sophisticated, experienced officers, pilots, crewmen, doctors, nurses, all stationed at Roswell at that time. And as a result, there were more Soviet spies in New Mexico than anywhere else in the country. And according to the Air Force Project Blue Book, there were also more UFO sightings in New Mexico at that time than anywhere else in the country. So there was a growing concern that someone else was a little bit more than curious about our military potential at that time. And there were even sightings around Roswell at that time leading up to this very incident. And it was the late evening of July 3rd, and this was after a two-week wave that had originated right where you are, Brooks, as far as in Washington and Oregon and Idaho, and it moved from the northwest and then swept through the southwest and then across the rest of the country in a two-week span. And all your listeners could go to any public library and pull out all the microfilm and pull out as far as all the major newspapers at that time, and they would see banner headline after headline, day after day, about the flying discs, about the flying saucers. So there was no question something was invading our airspace at that time. The military was scrambling aircraft, you know, every day with an attempt to either bring something down or to at least capture it on film. So we weren't talking about weather balloons. We weren't talking about astronomical, you know, misidentifications or weather anomalies. It was somebody else's hardware. There's no question of that. And on the late evening of July 3rd, there was a severe lightning storm in the central part of New Mexico. The high desert area, open range, a lot of cattle ranchers. And the ranchers would describe that they heard between the thunderclaps something that sounded like an explosion. And it was the next morning that a ranch foreman by the name of W.W. MacBrazel was surveying the 75,000-acre ranch that he manned at that time.
And that's a big ranch.
And then today it's 85,000. And there was 700 head of cattle at that time, 700 head of sheep. And because of the monsoon weather patterns during that time of year, you would get torrential rains like 5 to 6 inches in one pasture and nary a drop in an adjoining one. So they would shift the grazing patterns of the livestock. So they would go check right after a heavy rainfall, and they would also check if any livestock were struck by lightning. Well, about 10 miles from the main ranch house, just imagine, you just said that's a huge parcel of real estate, that you travel 10 miles across your property to get to the other side. And Brazel discovers this huge debris field. It covered almost a 3/4 mile in length, a few hundred feet wide. It was in a fan pattern, fan shape, and as he got down from his horse, it was like nothing he had ever seen before. And Brazel had, you know, before picked up weather balloons, had gathered up such debris, so balloons and their instrument boxes and their payloads and their radar reflector kites were nothing unusual for any of these ranchers. And he would take some of the debris to some of the neighbors, and nobody could identify it. And Brazel was told about the reward that was being offered at that time. There was a $3,000 reward being offered for anybody who could present physical evidence. Well, this is 1947, so obviously he doesn't sound like
$3,000 is a lot of money. In
at that time, it was a year's income, right. And so Brazel would complete his chores through the balance of that week and report the find on Sunday, July 6th to the Chavez County Sheriff's Department, Sheriff George Wilcox. And they in turn would contact the Roswell Army Airfield, the 509th Bomb Group.
Well, no, that wasn't the first people that he contacted, though, right? I mean, this went on for, like, several days. Were there
several
people
days
going out there and picking up souvenirs? Was
precisely.
Were there locals going out there?
Exactly. And you raise a crucial element in this entire timeline, this entire story. And anyone who still considers the possibility that this was something of ours, this was something that we attested gone off course, gone awry.
Mm.
The problem is, with that explanation, is as you just described, Brooks, that material was out there for days. And this is high desert territory. I myself have been up in a small plane over the area on a number of occasions. We've been up in helicopters on an equal number of flights. And once you are airborne, once you are 100 feet up, you realize that the high desert is totally unobscured. You can literally see for 50 miles. But the point is, for the very fact that even once the Roswell Army Airfield was notified, now let's keep in mind this was a 4th of July holiday weekend, and none other than the very base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, is immediately alerted to the find. And after he actually examines some of the material, he doesn't just dispatch a couple low-ranked grunts, a couple MPs to go check it out.
Mm.
He sends the two head of intelligence from the base.
How about that? Because nothing of theirs had called in missing. Nothing of theirs had said, you know, we're going down, mayday, mayday. They had no idea anything had gone down out there.
Precisely. And for that very reason, the fact that we weren't missing anything, they weren't looking for anything, that means it wasn't ours.
Mm.
It's that simple.
That's a good call.
It's just that simple. So the head of intelligence of the 509th, Major Jesse Marcel, in the event it's something domestic, and the head of counterintelligence, Captain Sheridan Cavett, in case it's something foreign. Because as even Blanchard, even before he died, would always tell people, at first they thought it was Soviet because nobody could identify any of the material. But upon examining it, holding it in their hands, they quickly realized that it was above any technology on this planet.
Yep, nothing from around here.
Blanchard's daughter described how when her father came home that very evening, that very first night, and he talked about, first of all, she never saw him. So beside himself, so troubled. And here was someone who would have been number two pilot to drop the atomic bomb. He was being schooled. He was being, you know, prepped to eventually be the chair of the Joint Chiefs. He was considered one of the best pilots in the military, had flown many a bombing raid during World War II. And yet this was something that really upset him. And he would inform his wife that a flying saucer had crashed north of town and that the wreckage had all types of strange writing on it. And then he would also add, and there are bodies. They look human, but they're not human. They're not from here.
Wow.
So he was already making such pronouncements just, you know, within hours of you know, being informed of the crash. So, again, I can't emphasize enough. We weren't missing anything. And the very highest trained military bomb squadron in our military at that time just happened to be the very first ones to arrive.
From the military. There were neighborhood folk that showed up, right? Because, I mean, after all, they'd had weather balloons crash on their property before, and you don't want the sheep and cows eating that stuff. You know, people kind of team together and go out and pick it up. But what did the people say when they picked it up? Did they collect it? Did they think
they
it would be worth money? Or?
They retrieved. They took souvenirs. This, again, was at a time when tires were considered gold as far as wear and tear. Gasoline, after the war, was still in shorter supply. And so they were actually driving 10 to 50 miles to get to this site.
That's a long way,
and
40 miles an hour to go out
and
there.
Most of it cross-country. Almost all of it on dirt-packed roads, and at the time when they would still be, you know, at the peak of, you know, conducting their ranch work. It's Friday and Saturday, so there were two work days as far as they were still concerned. And yet, we've heard from so many of them and so many of the families and how they were hiding pieces under floorboards in storage sheds, and down in fruit cellars, you know, under the ground.
But the military show up and say, gee, how long has this stuff been laying around? Well, I don't know, 6 or 7 days. And the panic that must have struck them, like, oh, my gosh, this stuff's getting packed off to 5 counties.
Precisely.
We've got to come down here in force and collect all this right now.
And from all accounts, they did. In fact, we have descriptions of them pulling up floorboards, emptying out closets, turning over mattresses, dumping over water tanks, slitting open bags of cattle feed, all in an attempt to retrieve every last piece. And what we're talking about, when we talk about the wreckage, when we talk about the pieces, and you're certainly familiar, but again, for your audience, in some cases, or not, I asked them to consider if this sounds like anything conventional, especially circa 1947. Witnesses described paper-thin, metal-like material, larger sheets that were about 4 foot in diameter, slightly curved, but you couldn't cut through it, you couldn't burn through it, you couldn't shoot through it. Major Marcel described how they took a 16-pound sledgehammer and even pounded on it, and they couldn't even scratch the material.
Wow.
Other I-beam-like structures, about the thickness of your pinky, with a raised I-beam and a lower engraved portion with hieroglyphic like symbology that ran the lengths of each piece. And yet, no one able to decipher. They would describe that it looked Russian or it looked Chinese, but it wasn't. Again, it was something that nobody had ever seen before. Symbols. They were just geometric symbols of sorts. And then witnesses also described silken strands of material that you could hold a lighter up to one end, and the light would emit out the opposing end. Well, you're talking fiber optics in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
And then the very material that we refer to as our Holy Grail, the material that once again was paper-thin foil metal-like material. And again, you couldn't cut it, you couldn't burn it, you couldn't drill through it, but you could crumble it in your hand, you could crease it, you could fold it, you could wad it into a ball, and you'd place it onto a smooth surface and it would flow like water. It would just smooth right out. In other words, it possessed perfect memory.
Wow. Now, this isn't the stuff weather balloons is made of. I mean, people knew what weather balloons were like. What did the military say this stuff was?
Well, as eventually would happen, 2 days after. Now, here's another crucial point. Anyone who suggests that the military overreacted, that Colonel Blanchard and Major Marcel and other officers overreacted and put out that press release where they actually announced to the world at noon Central Standard Time on Tuesday, July 8th, that they had actually captured a flying saucer. They had the material in their possession for 2 full days. And Blanchard, after he had dispatched Marcel and Cabot, the 2 intelligence officers, to follow the rancher, Brazo, back to the site, he would get right on the phone. He would call up his commanding, his superior officer, who was Brigadier General Roger Ramey of the 8th Air Force at Carswell Army Airfield in Fort Worth, Texas. And Ramey hightailed it right to Roswell. He came right, over, it was an hour flight, and we've been able to document that Ramey was no stranger to Roswell. They had the bomb. It was one of the reasons that he probably spent as much time in Roswell as he did even to his assigned base in Fort Worth, Texas. His chief of staff, Colonel Thomas DeBose, would have been left behind, and DeBose described to us, because Ramey was not available because he was on his way to Roswell, that General Clements McMullen, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, contacts DeBose from the Pentagon in Washington that very evening and orders some of the material immediately flown to Washington.
Yeah, that's
the point I'm making is, the point I'm making is that Washington already has the material 2 days as well before the press release.
Wow.
This was all highly orchestrated. They had ample time to think this through. And the next day, they would become even more concerned because civilians would find the second site, the impact site, much closer to Roswell, just north of town. And here's where the bodies were found. And that became a much bigger concern than just the debris field. And it's our conviction, it remains our conviction, that they used that first press release as a deterrent, as a distraction from the much more sensitive site just north of town. The people, the press already were talking about the rancher and the debris field. And what they did was, as they learned during World War II, the creation of the straw man, first you build it up, then you tear it down. They couldn't deny something happening, something crashing. So what they did was they announced the crash, but 5 hours later, they explained it all away, as you've been alluding to, as merely a weather balloon.
Mm. Now, when the second site was found, did souvenir hunters go out there as well, or did the presence of the bodies kind of spook them, or were all the crew members dead, or was there one alive?
Well, to answer your last question first, there was a survivor from firsthand testimony. For about the first 15 years of the investigation, we were hearing of much secondhand testimony from family members that their husbands, their fathers talked about one being walked into a hangar or one being walked into the base hospital. And in these past 5 years, we now have a number, 3 to be precise, firsthand to a survivor. And one, for example, who we describe in the book, was one of the MPs who had just finished his duty, his shift for that day. And yet he was still assigned to get over to the big hangar, P3, Building 84. It was a B-29 hangar. And that's where all of this went down. It's where all the wreckage, it's where the remains of the ship, it's where the bodies were all transiting through before being crated up and shipped out. And in the case of the survivor, they were ordered to escort a number of the gurneys over to the base hospital. And one of them stepped onto a covering, a sheet. And that's when they saw the live one. Now, even according to his wife, now this man, the first time we talked to him, became extremely emotional. I mean, he wept, he sobbed, right in front of us. And his wife explained to us later that they have not slept together in the same room for over 30 years because of the reoccurring nightmares, that he screams out. He just bolts up from, you know, his sleep during the middle of the night because he can't get that face out of his mind. And so even his wife becomes somewhat of a first-hand witness in that regard because she sees how he's been traumatized.
Sure.
By what he experienced. And again, I defy anyone to explain how, you know, these people who saw, who witnessed, you know, just some of the worst horrors imaginable during World War II. And yet this was the breaking point. This was something. And as one of the witnesses described to us, then when he came back to the base that first night and he walked past some of the barracks, he overheard men were either crying or saying the rosary. Because where is this in the field manual? Where do you go for answers regarding this particular incident? They were behaving as though they were walking through all of this for the first time. And at that time in 1947, the military was God. Coming off of the victory as far as in both Europe and in the South Pacific, the end of World War II, whatever the military said, the press, the people, accepted without any reservation. And so when they came out with the balloon explanation, most people were actually quite relieved because they weren't ready. Nobody was really ready at that time to deal with this. I mean, we were still in a slow process of recovery after the war. It's just 2 years later to then have to deal with the very fact that we're not alone in the universe.
That's a big one.
And you don't know if it's, you know, was an advanced in a vanguard of an invasion fleet. We have no idea if we're dealing with something hostile or not. No answers whatsoever. And it's one of the reasons, Brooks, that I still maintain it's being covered up and that it's still a cover-up of ignorance because you have physical proof. But again, you don't know from where, from why, or from who. It isn't your proverbial landing on the White House front lawn and an exchange of information.
Well, I can see that, you know, sociologically, we weren't ready for that. We had victory, but we're still suffering from shortages of all kinds of things. And
exactly.
Realizing that we're not alone in the universe, realizing that we're being visited. I mean, it's one thing to see them fly across the sky. It's another one to hold a piece of their ship in your hands and to actually see a being from another world, incapacitated as it was still not only mind-altering but religious-altering. I mean, we were a nation that relied upon God to deliver us from an evil unspeakable that was taking over the world, and we believed that God not only established our country but delivered us from that evil, and now we realize that an uncreated being is on our planet, and oh my goodness, what are we going to do now? So the military is throwing cover stories out, one and then another, and then they back up from that one. At the end of the day, you know, were the people really relieved that the government wasn't standing behind the UFO story, or do you think they got frustrated with the idea that, wait a minute, you know, all this is being carted away, and they're going to cover it all up, and no one's going to know a thing?
No, as I had mentioned, I think there was a sigh of relief throughout the nation at that time. Even according to all the newspaper polls, only 2% of the surveyed people even consider the possibility that all the flying disc, all the flying saucer reports at that time were dealing with, you know, an intelligence off the planet.
Ah.
Most people still believed, again, we still had few answers regarding the atomic bomb. Most people still really heard nothing of the devastation, saw nothing of the devastation of what actually had transpired as far as over in Japan.
Oh,
just
right,
2 years
right.
before. And so it just seemed to be a continuation on that process, on that technology. And so this was nothing new to us. We just, in fact, also the way the White House, as well as the Pentagon, was being pressured for some acknowledgement, some admission to the fact that, please tell us, it's just one of ours, and, you know, we'll be happy to accept that. We won't ask another question.
Yeah.
But then you started to get such high-ranking officers as General Nathan Twining of the Air Materiel Command, and even the president himself at that time, Harry Truman, saying that it was nothing of ours that we were aware of. Twining stating that we weren't testing anything of that nature, as described for those first 2 weeks of, you know, summer 47. And then just before Roswell, the slight turn of consideration, and more scientists are being questioned. Could we be dealing with something interplanetary? We certainly had very little knowledge of our own neighbors at that time. And clearly the speculation that we were dealing with something from either Mars or Venus. So to go back and look at, you know, these articles and these interviews with these college professors, and it's really fascinating because you see how far we've come in these just past 50 years in even our own knowledge of our own existence within our own galactic neighborhood. And yet here, and also keep in mind, the Orson Welles radio dramatization of War of the Worlds, which had just happened just 9 years before, was very fresh in their memories. So yes, I've heard that it's one of the reasons the press did immediately drop the story, because everybody just wanted to get on with their lives. Everybody wanted to just resume their lives, which had been so disrupted during World War II. Their husbands were home, their sons were home, their daughters, and the like. And now it was time for the country to heal, for the world to heal.
Sure.
And this had thrown a major monkey wrench into the works. And I think it's another reason that it's been such a small circle of people who had that need to know.
Well, there's more than that. You know, you have, you know, a country wanting to heal, wanting to get prosperous again, wanting to get about the business of being patriotic and being free and not have to deal with being visited by extraterrestrials at this time. How long did the Roswell crash sit in ignominy before investigative reporters started digging it up, started looking for pieces of evidence, started trying to track down witnesses? When you all got involved in it, some of the case had already been investigated, you know, to the end of the cold trail, but it really took tremendously dogmatic investigative techniques to build the library of evidence that you all have. How long did it sit before you got on the trail?
Well, as you had mentioned, that it already had come out to some degree, even 10 years before us. And that was rather serendipitous in that the very intelligence officer I had mentioned earlier, Major Jesse Marcel, who had retired a lieutenant colonel. And Marcel became quite the fall guy, the patsy. He was the one who was ordered to pose with the very weather balloon, which was substituted for the real material.
Oh, I bet he liked that.
Well, if you even go back and look at the scowl, look at the expression on his face in the two pictures. Even his family to this day, his son, says that my father is doing all he can do to control his emotions, what he knows to be the truth, and the fact that above everything else, he was still being a good soldier. He was following orders. And so there was the better part of valor, supposedly, on his part. But Marcel was told at that time, be a good soldier. Just fall in line. Just be patient. It's all going to come out in a few years. Because we got to, make sure before we make the announcement. We got to know precisely what we're dealing with here. And so he would wait 5 years and 10, 15, 20, 25. No sign that it was ever going to come out. And he was dying of emphysema at the time, in the late 70s, 78 to be precise. And he was a ham radio operator. And he started talking about it. And, he was kind of testing the waters. And he talked about how he had actually handled pieces of the flying saucer. And then when he was actually interviewed by the press, he would talk about, and he would state, being familiar with all materials, both domestic and foreign, this was something quite different. This was something I had never seen before. This was something not manufactured, keyword, manufactured on this earth. And the sad thing is, the only publication that would even touch the story at that time was the National Enquirer.
Oh, how about that? So the man in black movie was right.
Here's a lieutenant colonel, head of the most famous, most prestigious atomic bomb squadron, for its time. And he talks about handling pieces of a flying saucer, something not manufactured on this planet. And they still won't touch it. They still turn and run the other way. Such was the programming, the conditioning through those 30 years. It wasn't just Roswell that was explained. This was now 9 years after Project Blue Book was shut down, the most famous of the three UFO projects. And the government would have us believe that it was all explainable. It was all nonsense. It was all of a weather or astronomical or conventional nature. And here's somebody, again, was throwing a monkey wrench into the works.
Now, the military really didn't believe their own story. I mean, they were just kind of sticking by their guns, and by now, we can't go back and really admit what really happened, even if the modern society is ready to accept it, and they've been softened up by Hollywood and popular stories. We still can't go back and admit that it was something off-planet that we recovered. And we can't admit that we've got it holed up in some warehouse and that we've been reverse engineering it for the last 50 years. What is the feeling now? I mean, now we're getting to the second and even third generation of retired military. And I got to tell you, people are people, whether they're wearing a uniform or not. And patriotism often does not trump entrepreneurship. Somebody out there knows something has sequestered a little piece of metal somewhere or a photograph somewhere. How close are you to getting the padlock off of that warehouse door?
Well, as I mentioned, it remains our holy grail. We've had numerous false alarms. We've had numerous opportunities where we came close to actually recovering a piece of physical evidence. It's one of the reasons we've had, to date, 3 archaeological digs at the very debris field I described early on.
Uh-huh.
And we're planning on a 4th one. We still believe there, as you described, witnesses who managed to slip a piece away, hide a piece, bury a piece, something that, unfortunately, they maybe died and never had an opportunity to bring forward. I can't tell you how often we've had families search through attics, basements, through personal possessions for nothing more than my father used to, you know, brandish this piece of material, and he took a hammer and he smashed it all into a little cube, and then he laid it down and it just smoothed right out. That was one account.
And wow.
I mean, it's a bit imposing on our part to say, well, we'll come and do the search. So you have to always rely on the discretion of the people to actually take the time to do it. But when you tell them, it could be worth, you know, millions, if not even more, if it's the genuine article. And unfortunately, procrastination still seems to be one of the true, you know, arts within the human nature. In that, unless it's something right in front of you, who actually takes the time to look for something sight unseen?
Sure.
When there are no guarantees. We would, because we now have become, you know, very convinced to the authenticity, the credibility, the very nature of the incident itself. So we still remain very optimistic that a piece remains out there, and we just hope we get to it before our officialdom beats us to the chase.
Mm.
You mentioned photographs. Within the last few months, with the passing of one of the men who was part of the recovery team, he had accumulated, he was an amateur photographer, and albums of photographs taken at that time, and pages even marked Roswell, 1947. And I find it a little curious, why would a group of men have a piece of metal sitting on the tail of an army truck with them all posed around it? So we're a little curious about that, and we're waiting to secure an actual print of the picture and then have it computer analyzed and see if the piece is perfectly smooth, if it's textured, if it shows anything in depth and detail that might resemble, you know, part of an aircraft or anything else of ours, or if it truly looks like something a little unusual. So there is potentially photographic evidence. We do have a copy of a photograph from a metallurgist who claims that he managed to secure a piece that he kept in a test tube. And we have a photograph of that. Well, obviously we're hoping to actually arrange testing of said material. But it's kind of like Art Bell, when he used to talk about art's parts. And he would talk about actually possessing, you know, pieces from other crashes. And we put out we had a press conference, we put out the announcement that we were offering $1 million through the museum, the Roswell Museum, for an authenticated piece of material. And we made sure that anybody who ever claimed, especially colleagues within the UFO community, claiming they had an actual piece, well, why won't you turn it up? Aren't you interested in $1 million? Aren't you interested in, you know, establishing that this is the genuine article once and for all? Unfortunately, a lot of these people, they love to maintain the mystery, the mystique.
Uh-huh.
You know, they have something that nobody else has, and they play it for as long as they can.
So, goodness my. Well, yeah, we'll cover
human
that more
nature too.
In our next hour. We're going to take about a four-minute break. Let CNN play their news on KFNX 1100. We'll be back with more Don Schmidt right after this break. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming your way. You know, the foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, has been out for a short time, and we want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. This final work of the trilogy has been crafted so that you will have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. By the way, the trilogies are packaged now, discount prices, and if you'll purchase, you'll get the first two volumes, volumes one and two, in audio for free. So if you're not a big reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. You can listen to it while you're driving down the road. We're glad you're here with us tonight. Our friends at KFNX 1100 will be joining us in a moment. Don't go away. 40 seconds. X Squared Radio is about to get squared.
Life. Spice. Expands consciousness. Spice is life to space travel.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. AccuWindow forecast just about 70 degrees. Our phone lines will be open this hour, toll free anywhere on Earth, 888-228-4494. If you're close to a cell phone tower, you've got free nights and weekends. If you're on planet, off planet, makes no difference. 530-776-5154. 530-776-5154. My guest is Don Schmidt. He's co-author of the smash book called Witness to Roswell. Now, there was a first edition that came out. This is a new edition. More evidence, more witnesses have been interviewed, and there is more to come with our guest, Don Schmidt. Welcome back to the program, sir.
Yes, thanks for having me.
You know, in 2005, I really thought this was going to break loose. One of the great investigative reporters, Peter Jennings, hosted a much-hyped program on UFOs, but he referred to the Roswell incident as a myth. Does this mean that mainstream media accepts the military story, hook, line, and sinker?
Yeah, when you think about it, yeah, we're both kind of chuckling because, as I often point out to the press, you doubt everything else the government or the military tells you except regarding this. We spent 4 days shooting with the Jennings crew, and that was after we recorded by his producer for a couple of months leading up to that July of 2005. And we were quite astonished that they were not interested in speaking to a single witness. Go ahead.
That's just beyond me. I mean, is this the same Peter Jennings who served as a war correspondent in Vietnam and exposed numerous military improprieties? Is this the same Peter Jennings who put his life at risk countless times on the front lines to bring us the truth? That Peter Jennings?
It gets better. We had offered them, and he was there with us at the time. We offered them Dr. Edgar Mitchell of the Apollo program, the last man to walk on the moon. Who grew up just south of Roswell back at that time, knew a lot of these people firsthand, would later actually meet and talk to a lot of the officers who were involved at Roswell. And Dr. Mitchell could tell you, as he would have told the Jennings crew, that none of them were talking about this being a weather balloon or anything else conventional. That they were all talking about not only that it was a flying saucer, but how they were threatened into silence, how they were pressured with the loss of their pensions, even their freedom, as far as being imprisoned if they should talk about this.
Well, doesn't sound like they were really concerned about, you know, the sociological stability of society at this point. They really had something to hide.
Oh, yes, they clearly did, and it had nothing to do with fear of mass panic or breakdown of organized religion as we know it. It was strictly self-preservation on their part. Now, remember, I had described how the Soviets were breathing down their backs, especially with the advent of the atomic bomb. And the quickest, the most urgent cry on the part of the United States government at that time was, well, can you reverse engineer that stuff? Can you develop it? Can we put it to our advantage? Could it provide us with any technologies that will even increase our superiority as far as within global airspace or on the high seas or, you know, any of our military potential at that time? I mean, the bottom line is that is always what, you know, the government is looking at. self-preservation. And they saw this as an opportunity. It's just that they've never really been able to, you know, fully take advantage of it. We're still, you know, flying jets. We're still shooting up, you know, old, you know, ancient rockets into orbit around the planet. And we haven't been back to the moon now in, you know, over 30 years.
Yeah, so, and we just heard the White House announce last week that human spaceflight for Americans is done. Unless you want to hitch a ride with the Russians, we're finished. We're not going back to space with human beings.
Sad commentary. And when you think about, just imagine, and as a young boy and growing up, and I just loved, I couldn't get enough of watching each liftoff, whether from the Gemini program right through the Apollo program. And it was something I think many young boys at that time grew up, you know, just dreaming of being an astronaut and exploring new worlds. And for all the promise, all the talk about being on the moon by 1970, the same talk already was about being on Mars by 1980. Manned mission to Mars by 1980. And the way it just all fell apart. And one can only imagine where we may be today. We may be well beyond using fossilized fuel and other, you know, technologies if only the space program would have continued. Because just out of, you know, necessity, just out of even the space race itself, that we put that first man on the moon. And we would have then put the first man on Mars. And what spin-off benefits each and every one of us uses every day right in our own homes, or the cars we drive, the equipment, the electronic devices we use in our kitchens and so on, all from the space program. And to think that there really won't be a space program any longer, that we're done.
Yeah, it won't really be exciting unless human beings are actually going out there. Sending robots and satellites out there with grad students is not the same as piloting a ship into the cosmos. You know, getting back
never
to Peter
gonna make
Jennings,
a movie about a robot in space, no.
Exactly. What's exciting about that? You know, Peter Jennings knew he was terminally ill. He had a lifelong personal guideline of reporting the truth in spite of the military threats. I guess my question is, what scared him so badly that he towed the military story right into the living rooms of everyone who watched that program and then took the truth with him to the grave? I just don't understand that.
When we finished shooting that final day, one of his producers confronted us and said, "You people here have a very big story. And I only wish we could take the time to really report on it. We're going to have to do something of a very cursory nature, only touch on it, and hopefully it'll, you know, spring, you know, other fruit, you know, beyond that program." A former ABC reporter spoke to someone still with the network just before the program premiered, before it aired, because we were becoming concerned why within a week before the air date, ABC was requesting all this old B-roll, all this all previously shot material that we had done with other networks, because they were trying to piece together something as quickly as they could. And we had no idea. Well, then this ABC reporter had tipped off to our colleague, formerly with ABC, that ABC had released a press copy a week before, which included everything but the Roswell segment.
Oh, come
on. That had to go somewhere else for approval. That's how he put it. And whoever saw it didn't like it. And what you saw, what you see in the rebroadcast of that program is nothing that we shot nothing within those 4 days at all. It is all old B-roll, all old footage from other networks that they quickly spliced together within a week before the program aired.
Where's the footage that you shot with Peter?
I'm sure it's either, you know, someplace under lock and key, or it was destroyed.
My goodness.
But the point is, or anybody who saw that program, that first hour, we all came away thinking, wow, this is very objective. He's very neutral. It's actually very, very fairly presented thus far. Let's hope he does the same thing with Roswell. And if you think back, even his mannerism, even his whole line of verbiage, I mean, he uses the word myth five times in just the opening statement, introducing the segment. And it's one of the reasons in the book we did a whole chapter on, you know, the myth of Roswell. And we believe that now to be the fifth explanation. Because invariably, every time we do a program or debate with one of the skeptics, that's their final conclusion. This is a myth. It's all based on nothing. I mean, they all use that very same template regarding the case now. And so...
Well, evidently, we are not the kind of society that they think we are. When the camera lights go out and the batteries go to the recharge cradle, we don't forget the incident ever happened. And if the news media out there doesn't believe this, try looking at your newspaper sales now. Try looking at your network television news statistics now.
Well, public faith and confidence.
Yeah, the reason they're waiting is because you're not telling the truth.
And people know that. People realize that the news has become very one-sided, very slanted, very politicized. And I could have forewarned, because we saw this, certainly with the very subject of UFOs, for many years. We can only imagine back in 1947... officers such as Colonel DeBose, who was General Ramey's chief of staff, described to us. And he had retired a brigadier general. So we had a general describing how they substituted the balloon for the actual material. All that balloon wreckage that you see in those infamous photographs from that press conference were put there intentionally to divert the press, to throw the press off the hunt, off the scent. And DeBose described to us that when the press conference had ended, his superior officer, General Ramey, took him aside and warned him, "I don't ever want to hear you bring this subject up again." And that's what we've heard from all of these men, that it was a blanket of silence that just covered up the entire incident. But then you're concerned about the press still nipping at your ankles. So you have to take them in. And simply with the warning, now you are not to ever do a serious treatment on this subject without our permission. You will follow our lead. You will treat the subject as we instruct you to. And if you want to remain connected, if you want to remain licensed, if you want to remain in business, you will do as you're told.
Sure. We'll talk a little bit about General Roger Ramey. I mean, this was a generation that had fought two great wars and had survived on the premise that loose lips sink ships, that, you know, this was a press that wouldn't even photograph Roosevelt in his wheelchair, standing up. They
absolutely
had great respect
correct
for the military. And Ramey was, you know, certainly cast in that mold. And when he gave an order to the press, he expected it to be followed, and generally the press did do that. But who do you think ordered him to do this?
Well, the orders would have come all the way from Washington, going up even through the chain of command beyond his status over Roswell, and even to the very office of the White House, the Oval Office.
Really? So the president would have given this order?
Well, if you go back to even the president, the White House log in those crucial days, even leading up to the press release and the day after, you would have thought we were, you know, at the brink of war.
Really?
Because you not only have General Hoyt Vandenberg, who was chair of the Joint Chief, you have General Leslie Grove, who was head of the Manhattan Project, you have Doolittle, you have Stuart LaPel, you have all these people who, Symington, who was as far as head of the Department of War at that time, they're all meeting, and they're all meeting with the president and back and forth discussing who knows what. But it frankly brought back images of when the CIA director during the Clinton administration talked about if he met with the president once or twice a year, that was about it. And here you had, from all impressions, something big had happened. Twining, for example, the head of the Air Materiel Command, he cancels a tour of the Boeing factory in Kansas City to quickly go to New Mexico. Truman dispatches one of his consultants to actually travel to New Mexico and report to him on the incident. General LeMay, Curtis LeMay, dispatches one of his aides to go to New Mexico and also report to him directly as to the nature of the incident.
Mm.
And as the first head of Project Blue Book, Captain Edward Ruppelt stated in his book, Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, as he stated, by the end of July of 1947, the Air Technical Intelligence Command, the Pentagon, was in a complete panic over the situation.
Wow.
Now, can you imagine the Pentagon stating today they were in a panic? I mean, they didn't even state that after 9-1-1.
Yeah, and they certainly weren't in a panic during the Cold War, which we were well into by 1947. Don, we have a caller on line 2. Ramon, welcome to the program.
How's it going, gentlemen?
Hi, Ramon. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I got to say it's a great honor to have a man who's dedicated so much of himself to this, because I'm sure you're not doing this for the money.
no one does this for the money in this field. It's one thing when you sit down at the computer and type up a novel, a work of fiction, and just contrive it out of your head. But when you actually have to do the research, do the field work, be as proactive as you can on a day-to-day basis, and then sit down and write the book, you're absolutely correct. You're not generating any income in the process. And I'm surprised how often I've actually had people publicly attack me. Well, you're only doing this for the money. And it's like, I would just love to break even on a yearly basis. So it's because, as Brooks described it, it's the best of the cold case files. The very idea that we're still investigating something that happened now 62 years ago. And quite frankly, if it happened, if it's true, you're talking the biggest story of the millennium. So how does one walk away from that? I can't.
Well, at least speaking for myself and speaking for, I'm going to assume for Dr. Agnew's, our listeners, there's definitely evidence there. you know, me, myself, like, I've seen footage and, you know, I read books, and there's definitely something solid there. If this was a murder investigation, it sort of ended years ago.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. In fact, we make that very point that we could take this into any court of law and win without any difficulty, because the government, all they would be able to do in their defense would be to impugn and smear, you know, our witnesses. They wouldn't be able to substantively attack the case. I remember when the Air Force came out with their fourth and final, the most recent explanation, the anthropomorphic wooden crash dummies. And at the very end of that Pentagon press conference, the Pentagon spokesperson was asked by the press, well, what if the public does not believe this explanation? What next? And he very calmly responded, well, then I guess we'll be back in another few years offering another explanation.
Oh, my gosh.
So it became quite clear that all they're attempting to do is run out the clock, stall for time, until those final witnesses that could testify, you know, in our behalf, are passed on, and then it becomes cover-up complete. And so there, too, is another indication of their losing hand, the fact that they know at the moment we still have the upper hand when it comes to such testimony, such eyewitness, circumstantial evidence. And they're stalling. They're running out the clock on us.
Well, Don, one of the things we do as part of our government is we change presidents every 4 or 8 years. And the new administration comes in with its own heads of the various agencies and departments, and these are appointed officials. Some of them are bureaucrats and some are just cronies. But since the days of Roger Ramey and the White House and the Pentagon that kept it secret, there is a new generation, several new generations that have taken command. Have any of them tried to open the case from a congressional, a senatorial, or even a White House standpoint to try to crack it open and vindicate the government, or at least bring the evidence to light or satisfy themselves? Have any of them actually gone after the file?
We talk about President Harry Truman at the time of the incident, and certainly he was fully aware of every minute detail and repercussion and circumstance surrounding the incident and the fallout in whatever decision they would make at that time. Dwight Eisenhower was the chief of staff of the Army, so he certainly would have been fully aware and cognizant of, you know, all matters concerning Roswell. And even in his own memoirs, for a two-term president, he would lament how, as a five-star general, while sitting in the office of the presidency, the Pentagon didn't tell him anything any longer. And I think that was the first indication that, especially during the Cold War, they realized the less the president knows, the more it serves to protect the individual. It's that compartmentalization, that need to know. If you have individuals that possess, you know, some of our biggest secrets in their entirety, they become major targets.
Sure.
But yet if I need you and I need you and I need a 100 people to put together one equation to one, you know, situation, and therein would also lie the president. So I think they realized early on, especially with the Cold War, that the less the president knows, the more it protects the president.
How about that?
Now, Jimmy Carter...
You
cut out.
I was going to ask Ramon if he had any thoughts on that. He's sitting in New York listening
to... Yeah, I was... I was going to say, funny enough that you say that, because I've always heard people say the government can't keep that a secret. And my reply is always, well, it's not a secret. It's laughed at and ridiculed. And if the president really wouldn't find out, well, how else did you find out? And me and Dr. Agnes, like, I've seen them. You know, I've seen saucers. It was in the sky in the distance, but I've seen them, so I know they're real. So you can't tell me that they don't exist.
Well, you're very rational and very reasonable in your assertion as to even the nature of the cover-up. I mean, you describe it actually quite accurately in that it becomes a self-perpetuating cover-up. And that you're right, it has been leaking out for, you know, these past 30 years. The problem, as you describe, is that it's ridiculed. They're laughed at. They're not treated seriously. And then who's going to step next up to the plate and say, well, this is what I experienced. This is what I saw. It tends to drive them even into deeper silence, if anything. Mm-hmm. I was going to also mention how former President Jimmy Carter, in campaigning for the office, had promised that he was going to release all the UFO files, which did not threaten national security. Well, nothing happened.
Yeah, we saw nothing.
We saw nothing. And yet, when Carter's been asked about it numerous times since leaving the office, he'll comment that he can't say anything about it, but that they're still working on it. And then, the most recent certainly would be the efforts of former President Bill Clinton. And Clinton has actually made public statements regarding Roswell. And it's another question I often throw out to college audiences about the Monica Lewinsky situation. And that are people aware of the fact that Roswell is mentioned in the Ken Starr report? And obviously, you know, people, you're kidding. That's impossible. Well, when the grand jury had subpoenaed the book that Lewinsky had given Clinton for Christmas, when they retrieved it from his private study, they found it sandwiched between a book on Winston Churchill and UFO Crash at Roswell by Kevin D. Randall and Donald R. Schmidt. Autographed to the president. Now, when our previous book came out, before this second edition, when Witness to Roswell came out in 2007, and then last year, during the campaign, the presidential campaign, and the executive producer of the Roswell movie, which was based on that first book I just mentioned, when he attended a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton with Bill in attendance, he presented him with a copy of Witness to Roswell, to which Bill Clinton would comment, "I've always been interested in this case, and I only wish I could have gotten some answers."
Wow. So it's driven so deep, and it's behind so many doors that even the White House cannot get the key.
And it's frightening, isn't it? When you think we elect people to what we believe is the highest office in this country, in the world for that matter, and they do not have access. They do not have need to know for some reason. And who are the puppet masters? Who are the people? Who's the basement government, so to speak, that is actually running things? And I don't mean to sound conspiratorial, because to me, Roswell is not conspiracy. It is cover-up. But nonetheless, we're sitting back and allowing these people to decide not only for that generation, but for all, you know, subsequent generations.
Well, you know, it takes a lot to move assets around, even in a non-war footing. You said that the Pentagon panicked, and you said that there were strange militarized movements in and around Roswell. There were special aircraft brought in. There were freighters brought in. There was equipment, heavy equipment for moving flatbed loads and things brought into Roswell. What about flights and troop movements, equipment movements, or were there any special involvements of any of the national labs? That's a good question.
Well, you mentioned as far as even aircraft. I mean, there were special flights. There were flights that came in from Washington. There were special flights that went out. We even have the manifest of a flight that flew out a day after the weather balloon explanation with a crate which was under heavy guard hidden in one of the atomic bomb sites, and spoke to half of the crewmen on that flight, and they all verify and all have concluded that they flew out some of the bodies that were retrieved north of town. So flights that were unscheduled, personnel that came in. We've talked to doctors and nurses who were at the base hospital, and they talk about all the doctors and nurses they didn't recognize. That's clearly something big had happened. MP units that came in from Colorado and from White Sands Proving Ground. We even know the names of the two Secret Service agents that were sent from Washington to oversee the operation. So, by all indications, something of a highly unusual nature had transpired. Something had happened.
That kind of stuff can't move without somebody seeing it, without the press seeing it. I mean, when the ice cream truck shows up in downtown Roswell, New Mexico in 1947, the newspaper is going to snap a picture of it. Was there any censorship of the press or the radio or the newspaper in that area in that time?
Yes, indeed. In fact, when they had actually abducted the rancher, Mac Brazel, who had originally talked to the press, he had talked to specifically Frank Joyce, a reporter at radio station KGFL in Roswell. And KGFL managed to put it out as a lead story. And I think it was one of the reasons that they were forced to actually acknowledge the crash, that they had to acknowledge something up front before explaining it away as a weather balloon. Now, Joyce, as well as another reporter at that radio station, the late Judd Roberts, and even the son of the majority owner, Walt Whitmore Jr., described the ransacking and the searching of the studio, of the radio station, of the office, securing and retrieving every last word regarding the incident. Roberts described receiving a phone call from the FCC, from Washington, threatening them with the loss of their license if they put out any more information about the incident.
My goodness.
Senator Hatch, at that time from New Mexico, would reiterate that warning and that it was out of his hands, that they better do as they were warned. And when Brazel was secured by the military, he was then escorted under military guard to the radio stations as well as the two newspapers, where he recanted, where he retracted the original flying saucer story.
Now, he wasn't military, was he? He was just a ranch employee, a manager, right?
He was a ranch foreman, correct. And he was, as a civilian, he was not provided even with due process. I mean, they kept the man for about 5 days, kept him up all hours of the night, asking him the same questions over and over again. They subjected him to a full army physical. They would not even allow him to call counsel, a lawyer, or even call his own wife to inform her where he was. And
okay.
It's amazing that the military, I mean, and first of all, it's right in the Constitution that the military is not to take any action whatsoever against its own citizenry.
That's right. That's right. Now, the National Guard can, under order of the governor. But the actual
under order of the governor, correct.
Army cannot take action against U.S. citizens. I'm sorry, Ramon, didn't mean to cut you off. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was going to ask, and this is probably one of the biggest questions you get asked, is what would it take for it to finally come out? Would it have to be, like, I just don't know at this point, like, because they've been over the White House. That's been done. That didn't work. They've flying all over in different cities, over airports. There's pictures. You guys have physical evidence, and still nothing, other than them coming down and start slapping everybody in the face. That's the only thing I could think of. Like, in your mind, what would it take for it to finally come out?
In the earlier stages of our investigation, even up through the mid-90s, and when the late Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico was working with us, actually representing constituents, many of them who were involved with the incident in 47. And it was under the pressure of the resounding success of the first book we did, and then the motion picture, Roswell, based on that book, and the pressure from the congressman that the Air Force came out with their third explanation, the Mogul Balloon Project. And it's the same type of weather balloon, but that it was part of a top secret project. So it's the same materials, same reflective foil, neoprene rubber, wooden sticks, and masking tape, but nothing else that would confuse anyone to its earthly, you know, nature. But needless to say, I quickly called up the congressman at his office in Washington because I was concerned that he would accept it and wash his hands of the matter. And I'll never forget how, you know, he said right over the phone to me, "Don, they're a bunch of, you know, damn liars." And so my faith was renewed in that good, honest, decent people are still willing, more willing to deal with the truth, no matter what the truth is, than live a lie. And it increased my optimism at that time because I was also hearing from more and more people within the military that there was this growing faction of the newer, the younger military that wanted this to come out, that they were pushing for this to come out. But then they came out with Project Mogul, and then 3 years later, the wooden crash dummies. And it became quite clear, as I mentioned earlier, that they were stalling for time, they were running out the clock, and they were nailing down the coffin lid even tighter. So they're demonstrating absolutely no fudging, no budging, no giving in, no flexibility as to let's talk about this, let's see if the people are ready. I think beyond their ignorance on the subject, I think a lot of it also has to do with the fact that there would be a lot of culpability, a lot of responsibility regarding the fact that they did use the military to threaten civilians, American citizens, and possibly more. When we hear accounts of the way children were scared to death, and parents were told, we will kill your children if you ever talk about this again.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'll never forget one of the officers telling us at one time that we should look into all the accidents through the Roswell area at that time. And he very coyly remarked, well, they weren't all accidents. And so we've been looking into some shootings and even some suicides and through the years, and we even discuss and write about some of them in the book, some of the alleged suicides that the families still believe were of a more nefarious nature, and car accidents and other situations that may have been staged. It doesn't, you know, flatter me or pleasure me in any way to cast such aspersions to our military. And you've noticed, I'm very careful in even in using that word. I more commonly use the word government, because the military was taking the orders of the government at that time. They were doing what they were told. Because again, there was nothing in the playbook, nothing they could refer to in dealing with this. And they did all they could in just shutting it down as quickly as they did. And they made it up as they went along. And if it resorted to threats and possibly more, that's what they did. And I think therein lies that level of accountability that somebody would have hell to pay after all these years, that somebody who may still be alive, who was calling those orders, was calling those shots, was directing those people to conduct such activities against its own people.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't think that could happen in this day, but I'm reminded of the not too distant crash, the unfortunate reentry of Space Shuttle Columbia.
The news
media, national news, was telling people that picking up any debris in that field would be considered a felony, and that the area was being watched by high-powered space-based cameras. They could see everything. They were warned against souvenir hunting with dire consequences. And I understand there were people that went in there with jeeps and pickup trucks and whatever and picked up things and were never heard from again.
Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And with our technology today, when I'm asked, well, certainly if Roswell would happen tomorrow, there'd be no way they could contain it, they could cover it up. Well, you just cite the perfect, you know, recent example. All they have to do is put out such a threat, such a warning. And as you said, people conveniently disappear. And that's over something man-made.
Right, right. Well, somewhere out there is an airman or a soldier or a government contractor who wants to be part of history. They're going to get the key to either Don or Tom, and we're going to get in, and we're going to find a piece of this evidence, and we're going to bring it to light. That's why we do this, isn't it, Don?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Brooks, because if we didn't see a light, you know, at the end of our efforts, if we thought that the skeptics at any time were playing a winning hand, in defense of our research, it's an ongoing proactive investigation. We continue to, you know, allow the evidence, allow the eyewitness testimony, steer us in the direction of the final answer. And rest assured, when we complete the mission, when we finish the job, we're done. It's mission accomplished. We can't say the same about the government now up to their fourth explanation. And we certainly can't say the same about the scoffers, the debunkers, because I always ask the question, why the need for damage control? Why the need to debate and engage us? If you're 100% convinced to the contrary, why do you bother? Because when I'm 100% convinced, you'll never hear from me again. As I said, my job is done. And that's, again, that's where I remain all the more committed, all the more devoted, both Tom and I, that as long as we're alive, we're going to see this through.
I couldn't agree with you more. My last question, then I'll get off air. Have you personally ever received any threats from any weird person or just been followed around or found, like, hidden cameras or microphones in your house?
Early in the investigation, we talked about doing a bug sweep through the house and things, and I would have people within law enforcement who would even offer to do it. And I wasn't concerned at that time, and I'm not concerned today. Because for all the subtleties, the things that have transpired, I'm all the more confident we're going in the right direction. If nothing would have ever happened, I'd wonder if we were, you know, playing on the same court, so to speak. We've had incidents where we'd be talking to a witness and 5 minutes into the conversation, all the earlier commentary would be playing back to us in the background, and neither one of us recording. So somebody was, we were, you know, convinced intentionally trying to show us, you know, we're watching, we're listening, you know, watch your step. Don't get too close. Now, after all, I mean, it is a catch-22 for the government, for the military, because they can't play a heavy hand because, after all, it's just a weather balloon. They're just wooden dummies. They demonstrate, you know, any aggression, you know, towards us or our witnesses, it could open up quite a Pandora's box, quite a can of worms that would never, you know, be reclosed. So,
do you think there's? I'm sorry.
Go ahead, please.
Do you think there's anybody up there that maybe wants you to leak this out in the form that you're doing it, even though with the ridicule and everything, there's still a growing population that's saying, yeah, there's something to it. There's definitely something that happened. Do you think that someone is actually little by little giving you bits and pieces, like breadcrumbs?
So I think out there? That's a good question. I think most people would be amazed how often I have talked to even major generals who have told me to keep at it. We were going in the right direction. And if not for the fact they were under heavy regulation, that they were handcuffed under such security matters regarding the subject that they couldn't do what we're doing. I had a colonel with the Marine Corps call from the Pentagon a number of years ago. And after I called up the Pentagon switchboard and verified who he was and they transferred me back to him, he encouraged me as well and suggested that the closer we would get, the more difficult they would make it for us. And I think they've done that now with two more explanations.
Mm.
Because the press is just, you know, very, again, and, you know, sad to say, Peter Jennings, he went along with it. He didn't have to. I mean,
no,
it certainly could have been his legacy.
But by the way, those of you that are listening in Phoenix, this is a three-hour program. You're going to lose this broadcast in about 5 minutes when the CNN news comes on. I want to let you know that Don and myself and Jesse Marcel Jr. are going to be in Burlington, Maryland, October 30th through November 1st at the Vortex Conference. If you want to be part of that, just click on the Vortex Conference banner at X Squared Radio, get registered, and you can meet us live and ask your questions, and you can see the evidence for yourself.
And well, I think you meant Burlington, Wisconsin.
Burlington, Wisconsin. Did I say
yes.
Maryland?
Yes, yes. I don't know if there is a Burlington, Maryland, but and Stanton Friedman is also going to be there, so.
Shows what I know about geography.
No.
I wasn't
well,
reading.
As long as you wind up in the right place, that's all that matters.
That's right. Ramon, thank you so much for your call and for your help from New York.
My thanks as well, Ramon. Nice talking with you.
So as we start our third hour, we're going to be just strictly internet broadcasting now, and there are people listening right about now. Our Australian listeners, come on. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning there, and we're liable to get phone calls from anywhere. So I want to let everyone know that the phone lines are still open, and yes, if you're in the Phoenix market, of course, you can call. toll-free 888-228-4494. And if you've got free nights and weekends on that cell phone, or if you're close to a tower on planet, off planet, it doesn't matter to us, 530-776-5154. This is where we can talk about things we can't talk about on regular broadcast radio, and we surely appreciate the Phoenix market on KFNX 1100, 50,000 watts strong, and we appreciate you being there. Don't forget One Spirit Weekend coming up October 5th in Sedona, Arizona. Be sure to click on that banner and pick up information. Greatest weekend for your life if you're in that area. Don, one of the things about Witness to Roswell is that the book is so well put together. You would think an investigative book like this would be kind of a drag to read. I can tell you from personal experience, I've now read it twice, you just can't put the book down. It's like the greatest whodunit you ever picked up. It's one exciting interview after another. People just dying to be asked a question about their experience, about what they picked up, what they held in their hands, what they heard that night, or what they saw driving down the street. And I personally applaud you and Tom for your dogmatic effort to literally give up the privacy of your lives to go to the remotest, driest, most unforgiving country in the country to investigate this story. We are just eternally grateful to you for your dedication to it.
No, I am very flattered, and I thank you for your kind words. And as of the most recent trip in July, I have officially been to Roswell now 106 times.
Oh, my goodness.
New Mexico, 106 times in these past 20 years.
My goodness. Now, you said, you don't have to give us any details if you don't want to, but you said you've got an archaeological dig coming up. How soon is that, and what is the scope of work?
The problem as far as in actually arranging such a project is that we have a small window of opportunity, and that obviously we can't do it during the winter months because it can be frigidly cold through as far as that time period, and then through spring is one opportunity, typically end of April through May, and then through June, July, and August you run into the monsoon season, so weather is a factor. And so then our next opportunity is September into beginning of October. And then the ranchers do their herding of their cattle and sheep after that, so we don't want to intrude as far as their work would go. So it's a quick hit late spring or early fall that we have this opportunity. And so.
Now, describe just before we go to the CNN break here, what is the scope of work? Do you just go out there with a big backhoe or a scraper, or is it very meticulous?
We've used shaker boxes. We've used the backhoe. We've used a blade shovel. With the dig in 2002, we focused specifically on the gouge area where eyewitnesses described after the military cleanup, the military recovery operation, that there was still a gouge. It was about 10 feet wide, a few inches deep, and about a few hundred feet long. And long smoothed over through the wind and the rain erosion, and the backhoe would jump, would skip as it would cross dig along that trajectory. And as the ground was pulled away, and then from down from that site, there it was. It was a symmetrical V. It clearly showed an impact site. Something had actually hit and skipped across the ground at that point. So that was an exciting find. And a weather balloon obviously doesn't create, you know, a gouge.
No, it doesn't.
That desert sand. So, and when I say sand, it's just a a few inches on the top, and most of it is shale and slate stone as you dig below it. So a gouge certainly suggesting something that hit with some force and then skipped for some distance. So our next project would involve actually more people and expanding and moving out, because so much of the material was discovered downsite, that the wind was scattering it. It's an ongoing joke with us that we'd be better off looking in western Texas for the real material. So we want to fan out in wind pattern, in water, in erosion, you know, paths, and then also focus on predator sites. Because as you had been mentioning at the beginning of the program, that material was out there for days. And even the pack rabbits, the jackrabbits and the prairie dogs would have had ample opportunity to scurry a piece away and take into one of the burrows. I just can't imagine any of the soldiers back in that summer heat of July of 1947 sticking their arms down any of those holes. You know, with their, you know, real concern for rattlesnakes and Gila monsters and scorpions and tarantulas at that time.
I'm not sticking my arm down there.
we can lower a scope with a, you know, with a light amplification device and watch it on a monitor and, you know, use our own technology to ferret out potentially something that they didn't do back then.
Never know what you're going to find. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more. Don Schmidt, don't go away. X Squared Radio, one more hour. It's going to get even better.
Make me a witness. Take me out of darkness. And won't weigh it down with good intention. We'll make fire out of clay rather than vengeance. Will we burn?
Everyone is waiting.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio, third hour. We're getting all 3 hours. Please let us know. We'll get a hold of that affiliate and make sure you get all 3 hours. By the way, we were in Salt Lake City this weekend debuting the new 2010 model electric vehicle. Did really well. Drove all over town. People were riding down the website as we went by. Went out to Rocky Mountain Raceway, and we're very well received out there. So those of you that are waiting for the electric vehicles to come out, you won't have to wait much longer. Heading up to Detroit to begin the crash testing process. Hopefully we come out of that by January, and you will be able to have your own electric vehicle, drive it around, and forget about buying petroleum to power your vehicles anymore. You want to know about it some more, click on the link at X Squared Radio, or you can go to globalgreencars.com and learn more about it. Also, don't forget, if you're going into business, thinking about being in a business, you have a business, you're going to need a business card. Don't forget about clicking on the Vista Prints banner at X Squared Radio, because the cards are free. Yeah, that's right, the price is free, and that's about as good a price as it gets. Of course, if you want those premium backgrounds and glossy finish information on the back, you can certainly get that too, and get it in your hands in 3 days. Now, it doesn't get any better than that. We'll be back in 40 seconds with more Don Schmidt. Witness to Roswell. Don't go away. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. And here, the results are always positive. We've got Don Schmidt with us tonight, co-author of Witness to Roswell. We're going to have to let him go just a little bit early, because he is going to be on Zealand Communications tonight with his co-author, Tom Carey. We want to let him catch his breath. Listen, archaeological digs are always exciting on this program. And during the break, I was just communicating with my producer how neat it would be to slide down there during the activities and maybe do a remote broadcast from the site while you're doing the dig. I think it would be neat to get on-the-spot interviewing and get the flavor for digging through the past to try to find the truth. If you
I think that's something that certainly could be arranged. I think for anyone, and I think back to the first time that I actually stepped onto the site, and you clearly take in the experience as though you're stepping onto a battlefield of sorts, and that if you accept that the incident happened, as once again described by the eyewitnesses, that something tragic happened, that people, that beings, again, something intelligent, something, possibly even beyond us, died at that site, and that it's one of the reasons that there is not a tourist attraction. There isn't anything that we've done to mar or deface or in any way disgrace the site. And we had a stone monument, an etched stone placed at the site in 2003. And we had a ceremony involving the surviving members of the Brazel family and some of the local press and some other dignitaries. And my partner Tom came up to me immediately and he goes, "Don, what happened? This isn't the correct site." And I said, "That's right. It's not." And then Larry Landsman, who was the executive producer of the documentary we did regarding the 2002 dig with the Sci-Fi Channel, who had paid for the stone, quickly approached me and raised the same concern. And I said, "It's close enough, Larry." And then he got it.
Yeah.
He realized that it overlooks the site. It's about a mile away. But whenever, you know, people need to actually go to the site and see something and take a picture, they're close enough. And so it's our way of also, you know, demonstrating our respect, not only for the incident itself, but all the people who were involved and the information that also died at that site. It's not what I would describe or define as a fine moment in our country's history, or a finer moment in, you know, our existence here in this nation, because the government took a lot of liberties. It rewrote a lot of laws. It resorted to a lot of tactics that I can't imagine many of them slept well during that time. The sheriff of Chavez County, the county that Roswell resides in, George Wilcox, who essentially was used as a proxy for the military to reinforce and reemphasize the threats to the civilians. His daughters described to us that the incident destroyed him. It's the word they used, that he did not run for another term of office, that he was never the same. And it wasn't because what he saw, it was again what he was forced to do, that he was actually forced to be heavy-handed and threatening to the people he was elected to serve. And how do you get over that?
Yeah, how do you get over that? Exactly. How do you,
and so,
how do you go to bed at night? How do you face your grandkids at Christmas time and realize...
Well, precisely. And when you... And it's one of the other elements when you ask me what sets Roswell apart from, you know, all the other UFO experiences. Well, I think I just hit on another, you know, level of uniqueness, of precedence, in that it also calls into play just about every human emotion imaginable concerning one incident. Everything from sadness to joy. Joy in that they were relieved that it was just a weather balloon, that it wasn't anything that was a threat or anything that the people needed to be concerned about. It wasn't a repeat of War of the Worlds from just years before. And the anger and the frustration and the fear and the intimidation and the harassment and the threats that left these people very bitter, very cynical as to all the celebration, all the opportunity that supposedly lied ahead after the victory of World War II, and it was all snatched away.
Sure. This is the greatest generation, and then you have officialdom questioning their patriotism. That's a tremendous dichotomy that this community has to deal with.
And to go on living, as I mentioned, this lie, even with their loved ones, and until their very deathbeds, that they finally would describe with apologies and with remorse the fact that they were ordered to keep this a secret. They were ordered never to say another word about this. And fortunately, many of these people, as you were even suggesting earlier, that there are some things that take precedent even over national security, over
sure.
patriotism, and that's family, and that's even love of country and love of God and love of family, to the point that I think you need to know. The truth is always, you know, the greater good in any situation.
Yeah, and what harm could it do to national security now? I mean, have we not reverse engineered every possible square centimeter of what we could have recovered? Look at the technology jumps that occurred in the 10 years following this crash recovery. Everything from transistors to fiber optics to now we have memory metal that behaves very similarly to what was recovered from Roswell.
You are correct, yes.
But even more importantly was the life form that survived and may have survived for years after this incident, stranded on an alien planet, and only the military to deal with, never really getting to meet the real Earthlings, never getting to report home.
And you remember certainly the, and which still remains my favorite UFO, my favorite flying saucer movie, the original Day the Earth Stood Still. And the character of Klaatu, played by the late actor Michael Rennie, and deciding that before taking any action, before, you know, essentially threatening us into giving up our attempts at atomic proliferation beyond our own planet, he decides that he's going to infiltrate, that he's going to exist among us for a period of time, and then to realize that we are worth saving. We are worth, as far as doing everything in his power, in helping us and assisting us to survive. And I would like to believe that, as you describe, that such a visitor who would not have that opportunity, who would, you know, strictly remain under, you know, military custody, would never grasp what, you know, the human, the best in human qualities is all about. That the military, you know, is strictly a dictatorship.
Mm.
And
are we really dealing with just the military? Because the commander-in-chief himself cannot get to the information.
I know. And again, it's twofold in that I believe it's to protect the president, but it's also a case of that they don't believe the president has a right to know.
How about
I think
that?
They keep in mind that in 4 to 8 years the president is walking the street, and the less secrets he possesses, the better off for them.
What a wonderful country. Don, we have Mark from Ohio on line two. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. I had a few questions for Don here.
Yes, sure. Mark, go ahead.
It seems to me that Roswell is kind of a tip of a rather large iceberg.
Agreed.
To me, it's the UFO cover-up itself has gone on so long, it's almost at the point of being a crime. And that what is being sequestered and hidden from the public might be the key to understanding our history, our theology, our origins, and just about everything else that's important to us. I wondered if you could comment on that.
I know it's been theorized that that too may be the reason, the concern on the part of officialdom as far as full disclosure. I would hearken back to the Alexander study that took place in the late 1980s. Dr. / Colonel John Alexander and his wife conducted a polling and a survey of all of the leaders of all the major religions throughout the world. And they discovered that 87% of the religions have absolutely no problem with accepting that there is other life on other planets. Now, if you recall, the Vatican addressed this very question this past fall of 2008. And it essentially reiterated what it said in the summer of 1947, after that first wave of UFO activity through that summer. And the statement was that it was the position of the church that the universe is most likely teeming with other creations. I also would point out, or I would ask, who operates more observatories around the world than any other organization? It's the Vatican. The Vatican, for example, is running the new observatory, you know, in the central part of Arizona.
Really?
Yes. Vatican operated.
I had no idea. In Arizona, they're operating?
In Arizona. And observatories around the world. So, what does the church even know that it's not, again, informing people about? One can well imagine back in 1947 that probably one of the first people that even the president would have called up would have been the Pope regarding this situation. Even the base commander, Colonel Blanchard, was a devout Catholic, and we have suspected and now have even better reason to believe that the base chaplain was even brought in for last rites over the bodies. And I often, you know, often asked what ramifications, what concerns after all this time, the deep, dark secrets regarding the incident. And as Mark just mentioned, this being, you know, just the tip of the iceberg, and I agreed that it indeed would suggest that everything has been altered, everything has been changed, that nothing is as it appears to us since 1947. I often compare when you see that the public as a whole seems to have almost an obsession with reality TV. And I've been involved with some of it, and you realize that there's nothing, you know, real about it. It's all scripted. It's all contrived. And you start to observe that everything's becoming more and more like professional wrestling. It's all staged.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I have to ask myself, how much has been staged since 1947? And to me, again, as Mark was suggesting, this being the tip of the iceberg, when we get shot down for just working on Roswell, all I have to point out, but who is guilty of the greater crime, so to speak? The person in my position who is merely trying to uncover the truth regarding what I believe would be, you know, one of the defining incidents in the history of this country and in all countries. Because if I'm wrong, it doesn't change anything. It doesn't affect anybody. It doesn't, you know, affect the stock market. It doesn't affect the price of gasoline. Nothing. But for all the reporters, all the scoffers, all the debunkers who have known otherwise, and have intentionally been willing accomplices to that lie, to that cover-up, Who's guilty of the greater crime? Because if they're wrong, if they knowingly participated in the lie, I would certainly suggest they are. When I was asked by former the scientific reporter at CNN, Miles O'Brien, and we were in the very hangar last fall, which I mentioned, the B-29 hangar, P-3, Building 84, where the wreckage, the ship, the bodies were taken. And he asked me, you know, Don, you've spent a good part of your life working on this one incident, this one case. You know, you've devoted so much time, effort. Why are you doing this? I looked him square in the eye and I said, because you won't. And I think I struck a nerve because not only didn't he like it, but then I went on to describe, you know, what I just said. For every reporter who has had a chance to finally break rank and go after this, all one needs to do is think about their spouse, think of their kids, think of the next generation, think of where the country's going to be in the next 25, 50 years. And if we can cover up something of this nature, what else has all been under that mountain?
There you go.
Of cover-up.
That's the iceberg Mark was alluding to, I think. Exactly right.
And to me, it's a case of when did we completely relinquish our authority, our governance in this country. They're supposed to be working for us. And as long as people, again, to use the old cliche, choose to be basically fat, dumb, and happy, so to speak, and that public apathy becomes the main controlling emotion in our society, then I guess, rightfully said, thank God for people like Stan Friedman and Tom Carey, and I'd like to think I'm contributing to that, and others working with us, that for little glory and little gain and very little return financially, I have nieces and nephews. And I know they'll have children someday. And I just can't imagine a world where all of this has died, is gone with the very possessors of the truth, and it's buried forever. That and 1,000 other secrets that impact us in subtle ways in our day-to-day lives. And we've given up, you know, our position as American citizens in retaining control of our lives, retaining control of our very existence here on this planet.
Mm.
And I think any human being that decides that anybody else is going to, you know, look out for them better than they will themselves, they're relinquishing, you know, that authority, that control. You're empowering other people to decide what you should know and what you shouldn't. And I, for one, I'm sorry. Anytime someone tells me the sky is blue, I go check for myself.
Well, I can tell you that millions of world citizens are with you. I mean, we hope for the truth, but I think, honestly, they hope for something greater. I think they hope that very soon we will stop being such a fearful and violent race, that perhaps we will become worthy of true visitation by alien races. I got to say that reading your book now, now two editions of it, has inspired me to keep a watchful eye on the sky and an open place in my mind for that possibility. What would you like to see happen now?
Well, you make a good point as far as if one just imagine what is the primary theme that another race, another intelligence monitoring our planet would actually, you know, perceive. monitoring our daily radio and TV broadcasts, what is the primary impression that would come across? Well, that we're a barbaric race of individuals whose primary activity is tribal warfare.
Sure.
And we don't get along with our neighbors, within our own families, let alone country to country. And we expect they're going to just land on the White House front lawn, and I'll guarantee you the first thing we would do is we'd shoot first and ask questions later.
Hmm.
Because we're a fearful people. We tremble at the thought that we don't have control. But yet we always give up our control. You know, we elect people to do for us, but then we complain a lot after the fact that we don't even take the time to vote.
They don't take the time to read anything they vote on.
Or read and become informed on things. That's why we tend to have knee-jerk emotional responses to issues. And it's no different when people ask me, well, Don, do you believe that Roswell actually happened? And I say, well, no, I don't believe it happened. I'm 99% convinced it did. I'm convinced based on what I have done, the research that my partner Tom Carey and I have done in attempting to demonstrate, you know, fact from fiction, which can be applied to any other issue as we go through life. And so I see, as far as where we go from here, certainly we continue what we're doing for the limited time we still have with the witnesses still available to us, but we increase the pressure on the political front. We increase the pressure within the media, the people that have been sympathetic to our cause. We have often had, you know, people within the press who have taken us aside and said, please keep me informed, keep me in the loop. Something breaks, I want to know. And we're loyal to these people. We realize that these are the very people that when we get a piece of that Holy Grail, and we call that press conference, they'll be on our short list. And so we can't sit back and rely on anyone but ourselves, you know, continue the good fight. And as long as I still get email and letters from people in the military that are, you know, cheering us on, you know, finish the race, do what we can't do. Do what we would like to do.
Somewhere out there, somebody's going to leave the door to this warehouse ajar, and you're going to get your foot in it, and you're going to break this story wide open with real evidence. Of course, witness testimony is not only compelling, it's also valuable in a court of law. People respect it. I would respond, you know, if somebody asked me, do I believe in Roswell, I would say, you know, belief is for something where you have no facts. Knowledge is dispels belief. It dispels myth. And it's time for real evidence. It's time for real action. It's not that it's been so long, who cares about it anymore? The idea of that is almost insulting. It's been so long. It's embarrassing that we have a government that has lost control of its own ability to communicate with its own people, and yet feels compelled to constantly deceive them, constantly feed them misinformation, constantly demonstrate on every front that they do not trust their own citizenry. That is a poor commentary on the leadership of this country.
And well said. And one would not even have to, you know, apply Roswell to such commentary. It could be most any subject, any contemporary topic that we are presently dealing with. Because to me, this is, you know, quite simply, as I was describing, demonstrated that if they can keep something of this magnitude a secret after all these years, what other secrets are we talking about? The assassinations of presidents, the assassinations of other high-ranking officials, experiments conducted on our own population, the fact that we still don't have a cure for cancer and that they're still using, you know, the very same treatments that they've been using for these past, you know, 50-some years.
Or the fact that we're still using petroleum as a fuel, or the fact that we're still putting men and women of incredible bravery on top of a rocket and lighting the candle to get them into space.
Using the same technology that originally was designed back in the 40s.
We should still be rubbing sticks together for fire.
So, well, and there are those who would have us all riding bicycles, I guess, if they had their way. But man's future has always been this being drawn to the stars, this idea that there's something, it's almost like a beacon, a light that has been drawing us. And it's one of the things that actually got me involved in the field, the subject to begin with. And anyone who's had the experience as far as being completely away from the city lights, light pollution of a populated area. And in New Mexico, for example, when you're out in the desert and you feel like you could just pluck the stars right out of the sky, and you just take it all in, and you just think, how can anyone, you know, look at such majesty and think, this is it, we're it? And you come away, and it's so humbling, and that you realize, you know, no matter what one's efforts, no matter what one's accomplishments, you know, in this life, it's just a trickle. It's just something that, you know, has very little impact, you know, in the big scheme of things.
Sure.
But yet,
all the energy and prowess and strategies that we employ to gain the most toys before we die, it pales in comparison when you just crane your neck back and watch two or three satellites go overhead.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think encompassing all of that and the respect and the appreciation for the fact that throughout the ages, throughout time, man has accomplished some tremendous feats. I mean, we honor and refer to these people as the great minds, the masters, the inventors, the people that have, by their very existence, by the fact that they didn't accept the status quo, they didn't just roll over and say, it sounds good to me. They didn't just live lives of complacency. And we're willing to peek behind the curtain, look outside the box, take us to another level of consciousness that was the true progress, the next leap, the quantum leap of technology that would usher in, you know, that next mindset, that next acceptance. And just as within mere years before the landing on the moon, there were still scientists saying it was impossible. We could never break orbit. We could never get a rocket to actually transport men to land on the surface of the moon. And just citing that example, and for all the naysayers, for all the people through history, that certain feats were not accomplishable. And yet we've gone beyond that point, and the next point, and the next step, and so on. And I believe UFOs, and I believe Roswell is just one of those. If I didn't believe that we honestly were making a difference, and that within my lifetime, that we were going to prove this beyond the shadow of a doubt. And I may have my 15 minutes and then sit back and go on with my life, but the point is, it was a life well spent in that, again, truth prevailed. The people accepting that a select few would decide for all. It's a complaint I often have with the press, that when did they give up our public watchdog status? They're no longer doing that. That was the reason I threw that question back to that reporter. Because you won't do it. Because you're not doing it. That's
Thomas Jefferson.
What I'm doing.
Thomas Jefferson would have said the same thing, that the key to freedom is an independent press. And that's something that we don't have anymore.
No, sadly.
Reminded that, you know, we are a people that specializes in the impossible. And you listed several things that were just impossible. And we did not look back. We kept stepping forward. We kept jumping off of the precipice and spreading our arms. And we did it. We succeeded. And now we're faced with almost the final impossibility. And that is a people trying to regain control of its own country. A people realizing that some group, some unknown, unelected, unpromoted group is telling us what we can and cannot know. And it's impossible to overcome it.
And even beyond the office of the president, yes.
Right. But
it's
not beyond the pen of Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, though. You guys are going to do it.
Well, I thank you. And as I said, as long as we're on the case, it is our ultimate goal. It isn't the next book. It isn't the next motion picture, the next interview, the next documentary. I mean, true, all part of it. And I wouldn't be spending this time with you tonight, Brooks, if, you know, I didn't feel it was important, that it was, again, my way of at least bringing our truth as we represent our witnesses, some still with, but many, you know, long passed on. And yet I represent them. Tom and I both represent these people no longer able to speak for themselves. And we present their stories, their testimony, with the hope that some people finally, you know, open their eyes and say, I need to look into this myself. I need to check into this further and see that not only did it happen back in 47, but albeit not directly, but more subtly, it's still happening today. People are still being threatened. People are still being silenced. People are still, you know, being ordered to keep their mouths shut on certain issues. Books don't get published. Magazines, articles are suppressed. Reporters basically, you know, march in one direction and get trampled if they're going in the other.
Hmm. Well, I can tell you, I'm thankful that the witness's testimony, some of it crying from the dust through the words of your book, Witness to Roswell, I'm thankful to have it, thankful to interview you, and I'm thankful that you guys are still after it. And I look forward to meeting you in October in Burlington, Wisconsin, at the Vortex Conference.
Are you going to be doing a show at that time as well, or?
I'm going to do a presentation on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition.
Right.
I may do a broadcast that Sunday evening from the conference.
Very good, very good. And because the speakers would all still be available, I don't think they'd be flying out till the next day. So I look forward to that.
Yeah, well, we'll just do a marathon. I'll bring a couple of microphones. We'll just set it on the table, and we'll have a panel, and we'll do it live.
Well, I'm sure they'll be accommodating, so I look forward to that as well.
Excellent, excellent. All right, I'm going to let you catch your breath. You've got another interview coming up with Z-Land Communications.
Oh, you can see that I'm very passionate about this. And I've always appreciated, whether in sports, politics, teaching, writing, what have you, that people, you love what you do, but you love it because you believe you're doing the right thing and that it's helping people, you know, live beyond their own means, in the sense that knowledge is power and truth is power. And as long as, you know, people have access to it, there's always hope.
That's what we have, messages of hope. And we appreciate you coming on X Squared Radio.
I will see you end of October.
Very good, sir. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk another time.
I look forward to it. Thank you, Agnew.
Thank you. Good night. My fellow Earth explorers, one of the things that becomes evident as you sit and you listen to these words, you listen to these interviews, the great passion of these men and women who have given so much of their lives to bring the truth to you. And we try to bring that truth to you here on X Squared Radio, and we try to limit the scope of the story to reaching out into space, to reaching out into the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. But we couldn't do it without you, the listener, sitting there with your headphones on, working on your project, on your blueprints or your maps or your stories or your drawings that you do at work, where you can sit there with headphones on and listen to these great words. And at night when you go home and you look up in the stars and you wonder about the future and the scope of this race and the idea that we have reached a precipice of our technology, that our thoughts, our ideas, our emotions, our pictures, our personalities can flash across the face of this earth in an instant, that we can communicate with one another on many levels instantly, and that now here in the remote part of Western Idaho, I can sit in front of this microphone and I can reach your ears now and perhaps paint a picture for you, a vision that one day, within your lifetime, certainly within your children's lifetime, we will rejoin the galactic community. This small blue ball in the blackness of space, privileged enough to have liquid water on the surface, billions of gallons of fresh water floating through its atmosphere every single day, watering the earth, marveling in the variety of life living upon it, marveling in the great freedom, the ability that we have to spend mere moments each day, moments, taking care of the basics of life, going to the grocery, buying enough food for a week, keeping it cold in our homes so we can access it anytime we want, without ever giving a thought of having to go put a spade to shovel, a spade to the ground, or taking some kind of weapon into the wilderness to hunt for the day's food. All of that is done. All of that is shared by those who have a passion and a skill for doing so, giving you all the free time you need to reach the fullness of your potential. And I would that you would see the schools of fish in this nation who are claiming that we are in a depression, who are claiming that times are hard, that money cannot be found, that there is no hope for the economy of our country. I want to tell you, swim in the other direction. Nothing could be further from the truth. We are so far from the poverty that you hear in the news media that you have it in your hands. All you have to do is work it. Mark on line one, welcome to the program.
Brooks, is that you?
That is me, one and only. This must be Mark Swanberg.
Mark Swanberg, yeah. I went down to the 2000 SETI, East SETI conference there, James and you, in 2007.
Oh, great.
I was there. Yeah, that's when I first met you. I've been following you. I bought some books from you, and you signed them for me. That was cool. Thank you.
I appreciate your seeing them. That's a great compliment. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I've got kind of a raging debate going with a friend of mine. He just thinks that the hollow earth theory is nonsense. And
it could be. We're going to find out.
You know, I go, huh?
I said it could be. We're going to find out.
I don't believe it at all. Huh?
Well, you know, the hollow earth theory has been around for, gosh, 1,000 years. It's about time somebody went up there and either proved it true or false,
sure.
Don't you think?
Well, I absolutely believe in it. I mean, it just makes so much sense. But, you know, some people are just not open-minded. And my main thing was I was looking around for when you might be doing that, and I couldn't find any information on that.
Yeah, we don't put out a whole lot of information as to exactly when. We, of course, there's only a few weeks during the summer when we could actually do an expedition. And although we planned to do it in 2007, it was just way too close to Stephen Curry's passing. We couldn't get things organized well enough. 2008, we really had a clear window. We thought we had it worked out. We had a joint venture with the Russians. All we really had to do was get maybe one Hollywood studio behind us, and we could have pulled it off. Unfortunately, we tumbled into one of the worst economies we've ever seen in Hollywood, and there was no money, no funds whatsoever to do the expedition in 2008. So we set our sights on 2009, and we decided to go to a larger ship, a 500-person ship, because we figured, gee, if we bring 500 people, that cuts the cost for a lot of people. We can have tourists join us, and we can have a core group of scientists. And everything was going great until the Russians denied the charter company access above the 86th parallel. Well, we got to go, 81st parallel. We got to go to the 86th parallel. That's like 550 miles away. So we couldn't get the ship up there. So we were back in the Russians' lap, and by the time we figured that out and reopened negotiations, 2009 was gone. So now we're setting our sights on 2010, and hopefully the ice isn't so thick we can't make it. We've got a fantastic Facebook campaign going right now. We created a widget, which is now passing way past the viral point on Facebook. And it's getting ready to explode around the world. And when that happens, very, very little effort. I mean, literally 25 cents at a time, the money will flow in and we'll be able to secure this charter. And the rest will be history.
Great. You know the picture with the Earth and it shows the opening? It's almost like this perfectly round opening up there. Is that something that they actually took a photo of, or is that's not animated, is it?
Oh, you know, we've done a lot of investigation into that photograph. A lot of people thought it was photoshopped, and so I gave it to an expert, a friend of mine, who took that photo apart pixel by pixel, and he said, absolutely not. It is not photoshopped. That is a real photograph from space. Two of them actually made it out onto the internet. We snagged that one within hours of when it came out. And that is an actual photograph. We don't really know how the ions lined up the way that they did, but you see the scope of these flux lines coming out of the Earth and polarizing that light to make it look like not only is there an opening, but we pretty much know the general location. And my gosh, look how big it is.
It's huge. What's your estimation of the diameter of that hole, do you think?
Well, you know, we
300 miles?
Yeah, we have two historians working on that. And one of them's in Germany, one of them's in the U.S. They've been working on it for many, many years and have collected a lot of photographs and a lot of maritime testimony. And they estimate it's between 180 and 300 miles across. Unfortunately, it's been covered with ice or with clouds, except for this one oblique shot. Now, we do have a photograph that's in the X-ray band that shows it very clearly. And it's that one that we're using for our longitude and latitude. That's why we're at the 86 parallel, somewhere around 146 east, which is way, way above the Siberian islands. It's never been sailed before. Never.
How long has it been possible to even get up there? I heard a little something about they're going to start opening up some shipping lanes because the ice has gone away.
Nope. It opened up late 2006. Actually the winds changed and blew the ice out into the warm water, which dissolved it. In 2007, it was open, and two ships actually did meet in the Northwest Passage. This is hundreds of miles south of where we're planning on going. But in 2008, it started to refreeze, and in 2009, they actually had a record ice freeze. They were seeing 10,000 square miles a day refreezing. And 2010 will probably be the last year that we can do this. The ice is passing the 3-meter point. That's not over 10 feet thick. And in the summertime, it thins enough where a large icebreaker can get through it. But 2010 will probably be the last year, and then it will refreeze. And it'll be covered again with ice, inaccessible.
When I saw that picture, 2007 there, 7707, It looked like you could see the hole, but it looked like almost like an asteroid belt around it. There was no clear covering of ice. It was just looked like a bunch of broken up ice cubes in an asteroid belt around that hole. From what I remember,
yeah.
How long has it been that way? I mean,
Year. It was only that way 1 year, and then it started to refreeze. Mark, I am completely out of time. They got to bring the next host on. Call in next week, and we'll talk some more about it.
I will.
I promise you.
Okay, thank you, Brooks.
All right, thanks, Mark. Earth Explorers, that's it. We're out of time. Got to bring on the next guest, next host. So we'll see you next week on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.